We start today's program with a brief consideration of political polls, including why they seem to be looked at more often, even as some wonder if their effectiveness and accuracy seem to be on the wane. The topic is the focus of a story in a recent New Yorker magazine called Politics and the New Machine. And to learn more, I'm joined by a local expert in the field, Mike O'Neill of O'Neill & Associates, and also the host of The Think Tank. Mike, welcome.
Welcome to you. Thank you.
So, Mike, let's talk about what people have this concern about. As technology has changed, as it seems that fewer and fewer people are responding to polls, are we paying too much attention? Is there accuracy in question?
I think that that's a valid concern. I've heard that concern for many, many years. You know, I started polling in the mid-70s, which was really the golden age of polling. And I'll tell you why. It was around that time that telephone subscribership became nearly universal. So you could get everybody by phone, which reduced the cost because sending people out in the field is very expensive. And there was if you worked at it, you could get very high response rates. Well, those response rates have gone down just a little bit every year for the last 40 years, and they're getting into treacherous territory. And here's the problem, is that the mathematics of polling assume that you get a very, very high response rate. We no longer get that. There's an aggregator of polls. There's several people who've aggregated polls in the last two elections. There was a proliferation of polls, and they started aggregating them and testing them against real results. And in 2008 and 2012, those aggregations were dead on correct. Mm-hmm. But I got to tell you, at a personal level, I'm very queasy, because even though the averages have behaved very well, the mathematical basis for asserting that they're absolutely dead on is gone.
What do you think is the appeal of these polls? Because especially in public radio, we will get calls from folks who say, stop talking about the horse race. I want to know what the issues are, and yet it's very
God bless
hard.
Him. God bless him. That is the NPR audience, and I tell you, you'll have the whole polling establishment cheering on that subject, but most of us have encountered the fact that when you let something out for public consumption, it's the horse race that gets run. There's a fascination with it. It very often means it precisely nothing. If you were to go back in 2004, 2008, 2012, look who is leading in the polls right now. You'll find names like Giuliani, Fred Thompson, the 999 pizza man whose name
Herman
I
Cain.
Forget. And the most enduring lead in that whole period was by Hillary Clinton over Barack Obama. We still, it's like, why, I think it's like looking in the mirror. We just love it. It gives some reflection on ourselves. There is some reality to it, but in a this far in front of an election, that reality is very transitory. In other words, I do believe it reflects where the electorate is at, but it does not reflect the fact that the electorate has not thought about this issue yet.
Well, does it make it more difficult when we consider the first couple of states, Iowa caucus, New Hampshire primary, those states are so different in terms of the way they view politicians?
Oh, yeah. And if you look at the Iowa polls and the New Hampshire polls, those are not necessarily reflective of the national sentiment. But this much I can guarantee you, the national sentiment in the third week in February will in part reflect what people have picked up from Iowa and New Hampshire, and that will have winnowed the field greatly. I always say, expect 2.5 candidates by the end of New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. You know, two real serious candidates that could win, and another one who's going to stick around for a while, but looks like an afterthought.
Now, the way that, especially on the Republican side, because there are so many candidates, the way that the polls have figured into who gets to participate in the debates, whether the big boy debates or the kids table debate, however we want to phrase that, does that indicate to you the power of polls, or does it indicate to you something just worse than that?
It indicates that the networks have to find some objective means of making a decision. I can tell you most of the people who do the actual polls that are being used are pulling their hair out saying, you know, you can't really, this isn't valid. We can't tell you the difference between 4% and 5%, but if you're going to set 5% as the threshold, you know, it's that's not a pollster decision. And most of the people in the industry don't like it, but they do it, I think, because it's hard to find what the alternative. How do you avoid having, I mean, the Republican so-called debates are not debates. They're horrible. With 10 or 8, you really don't get anything serious until you get down to 3 or even 2. And, you know, nobody wants to be excluding people early on, but you're not getting – to call them a debate, I think, is a completely misnomer. It's a sequential press conference in which everybody gets 5 minutes. You know, you just can't get informed policy debate given those numbers, no matter who's doing the moderation.
And have those debates actually affected the polls at all? Yes, we've seen a little bit of a creep of Rubio and Cruz up, but we're still seeing polls that indicate Carson and Trump in whichever order at the top.
I don't think there's much evidence. First of all, if there is evidence at this point, it's all secondary rather than primary, because the audience for the poll for those things, while they're higher than some things like have been in the past, they're still down in single digits as a percent of the electorate. So most of the information people get from the poll, if there is a definitive crowned quote-unquote winner, there tends to be, and that's crowned by the media, okay, there tends to be some movement in the direction of the person that won. But, you know, in this, with this format, it's hard to see how you get a winner. Unless somebody does something incredibly stupid, you know, like Ford and Poland and, you know, Soviet dominance, says something that is just complete off the wall wrong. Well, I was going to say, I've heard a couple of statements that I think are off the wall wrong, and they haven't hurt. So maybe even that at this point doesn't hurt. I was going to say, maybe you can kill yourself by doing something really stupid, but I don't think that there's a – I mean, and it's silly. What are you looking for? The zinger, which is pre-scripted? You know, short of that, it's not like somebody's going to come up with a profound policy statement given the 30 seconds they get to answer a question.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with Mike O'Neill. I'm calling him a pollster, although he's much more than that, political analyst Mike O'Neill of O'Neill Associates. He's also the host of his own program called The Think Tank. Mike, let's look at the changing demographics, which is we have more young people who don't have landlines. In fact, even middle-aged people who don't have landlines. We talked about the accuracy of polls. Are you looking at things changing going forward as we try to get, or pollsters try to get more young people involved and measure the accuracy of whether what they're thinking about, what issues they're thinking about, and whether they actually go to the polls?
You know, the bigger issue is response rate issues. The cell phone thing is gets tricky, but it largely is solved. You don't do landline only polls now. There was a period 10 years ago when the cell phone numbers were a little bit lower, and you could probably get by with that. That time is over. You have to include a very, very substantial cell phone supplement to every survey that's done. But what you can't get around is if you're getting massive rates of non-participation, then the question becomes, are non-participants the same as participants? And at this point, we have gone past mathematical basis for these polls working. They seem to, in most instances, still kind of worked out to be reasonably close to electoral results, but there's no longer any basis for assuming that they will. So I look at this and I see we're going to have some big disaster on our on the horizon somewhere, not necessarily in the political arena. It's the same things affect commercial polls that are done for making sometimes multi-billion dollar decisions. And what happens is the mathematical basis for asserting that a very carefully done poll is and expensive poll is done correctly goes away. People say, well, I'm looking, can you give me a really quick and cheap alternative? There are quick and cheap alternatives that have no basis in empirical science. And the temptation to do something, well, I can do this for 10% of the cost and give you the answers tomorrow, as opposed to, I really need 3 weeks to do this and it'll cost you a whole lot more. I think there's political predictions that are going to be off, and I think that there's multi-billion dollar decisions. I'm absolutely convinced that people will get wrong. I just don't know when.
How important do you think it is that people do have confidence in polls? Are we still a society that needs to have that confidence, or would it be okay if something like that happened, except for the people who made that investment? Will the rest of the public kind of go, well, I mean, come on, what do you expect?
You know, here, I think the importance is not in electoral prediction. After all, you know, wait until Election Day, we'll find out who won. I think the importance is if you're talking about understanding the sensibilities of the public on a lot of very core issues, they're important. I mean, polls are used not to, I mean, this headline stuff, they're used to set healthcare policy, which requires that you understand and consider the nature of health behaviors and things like that. I mean, 30 years ago, we were hired to help perform, for example, an evaluation of the Access Healthcare Program, which was a revolutionary change in the way healthcare was administered. And basically, you had to have real data on the behaviors of actual people in the program in order to evaluate its effectiveness. Mm-hmm. That's far more important than the kind of fun stuff that gets in the headlines of who's ahead today.
Well, the New Yorker article I cited mentions the impact that polls had on same-sex marriage, for example. When people saw polls that indicated, oh, maybe 55-60% even more think same-sex marriage is okay, that impacts things. Do you think that's important that polls impact democracy? Do you think they do?
I think they keep people from making false claims about what everybody wants. I think that's, and by the way, you go back to the history, that George Gallup said a whole lot of things about how it's going to make for better democracy, some of which sounds a little naive now, but I think there's a fundamental truth. Absent polls, I mean, reporters used to go out to a bar, interview three people, and then write definitive pieces about what people think. As flawed as polls are, they require a level of objective hands-off quantification. I think that it's not just the headline numbers. It's often what we call crosstabs. In other words, okay, these are overall numbers, but let's look at Hispanics or blacks or women or men or people of higher income, and let's see how those answers are different. And analytically, in terms of understanding what's going on in society, that's often a whole lot more important than just the top line number.
And Mike, just about a minute left. When we think about the future of polling, even if we look at the next decade, perhaps to two decades, do you see it evolving or do you see it fading away?
It has to evolve. Okay. I mean, the techniques that have been tried and true are becoming problematic given response rates. It's just that every alternative that's been suggested out there is shakier and less tested than good old telephone, you know, broad-based, including, you know, cell phones and all. The alternative is not clear.
Valley-based pollster and political analyst Mike O'Neill of O'Neill Associates. He's also the host of his own radio show called The Think Tank. Mike, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The Smithsonian Institution has been a key part of U.S. historical and cultural identity since its establishment in the mid-19th century. It's made up of 19 museums and 9 research centers around the world, and its secretary, Dr. David Skorton, who took over in July, will be in the Valley later this week as part of the O'Connor Institute's Distinguished Speakers Series, and Dr. Skorton joins me from his office in Washington, D.C. Dr. Skorton, what's the connection between the Smithsonian and Arizona?
The Smithsonian, as of this week, will have 7 affiliate museums in the state of Arizona. We have 6 right now, and we're going to establish one on Friday of this week, which is Western Spirit, Scottsdale's Museum of the West. Mm-hmm. And we have other affiliates in Tucson, a couple of them, in Bisbee, Peoria, and 2 other ones in Phoenix. They have a special relationship with the Smithsonian. They can take a loan of some of our collection, we have a lot of interaction between the professionals there and the professionals here at the mothership.
What is the importance of the affiliates? I imagine there are a number of people who can't get to the nation's capital, and this gives them some experience. But other than that, what are some of the vital elements of having these sort of branch campuses, as it were?
Well, let me take that from 2 different angles. One angle is exactly as you said. In fact, I wish you could attribute that to me, but this is a radio interview, not print, so we can't change that. One of the things that we strive to do is to reach out beyond the Mall and New York City, where the Smithsonian museums are, to the rest of the country and the rest of the world. And my predecessor, his term was that we wanted to democratize the Smithsonian, that is to get the collections more easily accessible to people everywhere, including, of course, the majority of folks who just, you know, can't come to the Mall. We're on a tear digitizing parts of the collection so that anybody who has an internet connection can look at them. Some of our museums, the entire collection is digitized. The Freer Gallery and the Sacker Gallery are both completely digitized. And, you know, given that only a very small percentage of the collection can ever be out in the museums at any one time because the collection's so massive, to have a collection digitized means that, you know, you can take a look at it even though it's not on display in the actual museum. So that's one thing that we're trying to do. The second thing is to have this wonderful network of affiliates literally around the country in which people in their own hometown can have a chance to look at some of the treasures and be inspired by some of the things that occur in any good museum, and these are all good museums, including but not limited to the actual collections that belong to the Smithsonian. They're not actually branch campuses, as you described them, just for a very small sharpening of that. These are independent, terrific institutions that have their own excellence, their own mission, their own connection to the communities. But they do have a chance to share with us collections and expertise from the curators and other professionals who really make these museums what they are.
When you think about the role that the Smithsonian plays, has played, is playing in the future, what are some of the roles you think will have to be? You mentioned digitizing things. I'm wondering about if the Smithsonian has to evolve this desire to still be attractive to generations that perhaps have a shorter attention span, have other things to do, and there's always this concern that are we aging our audience when it comes to certain things like that. Is that something the Smithsonian has run into, could run into, and is that a concept you're on top of?
You bet we're running into it, just as I would predict you are and all of us in every aspect of our lives. I just finished 35 years in higher education. Once in a while, I would say to an undergraduate, it seems like your generation has a shorter attention span. And usually she or he would say, nah, our minds just work quicker than yours. So I'm not sure which it is. But things are definitely changing. There's obviously an emphasis on the digital world. The youngest people coming into adulthood now have really lived all of their lives basically in an environment where you turn to digital sources to look things up, to figure things out for entertainment and so on. And so, yeah, like a lot of other cultural institutions around the country, we are evolving. And I think your word evolving is exactly the right word. Now, your classic idea of a museum, a place where there are treasures, whether they are treasures of technology, art, history, other aspects of culture, and you get a chance to be face-to-face with a work of art or with an object that has special meaning to the country or perhaps to the individual, with an explanation, that learning experience, I think, will always be there. But increasingly, we're doing things that are interactive, dynamic, learning, actually doing and making, using 3D printers, things like that. And so the trick for the Smithsonian, because of the breadth and because of how much the country depends on us to be face-to-face with history, art, culture, science, is I think to keep a foot in both worlds, to keep a foot firmly planted in the world where you can come and be in the presence of a special work of art or a special object with special significance. A sacred object in the case of the National Museum of the American Indian, objects of various kinds. And the other foot in the world of changing communications and the digital domain, and a lot of those things are happening here. And one of the things I'm going to do so that I understand the directions we should be evolving is I'm setting up a youth advisory council in the city of Washington to bring high school students in here and let them explain to me their ideas and try some of our ideas out on them and see if they resonate or not.
Based on the fact that you were most recently president of Cornell, you have had major, major positions in the past. And I wonder, what's been the most fun so far?
It's a proud part of American history. Not only do we portray American history, we are a part of American history. Secondly, the breadth of the institution is as broad as can be imagined. A lifelong Washingtonian, a friend of mine, told me when I was appointed to the Smithsonian, he said, do you want to know how to describe the Smithsonian in four words? And I said, please. And he said, everything under the sun. And so we do everything from astrophysics at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory to contemporary art, astrophysics to art. And so it's just thrilling. I do miss the undergraduates, but I love the populist nature of the Smithsonian, that people can walk into these museums without an admission charge and can come into the museums. And it's amazing to wander around the grounds, wander around the museums, the shops, the cafeterias, and see so many people, of course from the United States, but from all over the world, soaking up these treasures, soaking up the inspiration, and being changed by it in a very, very positive way.
It almost seems like partisanship is sort of left at the front door.
We do have controversies at the Smithsonian. You may have read about the controversy related to a couple of our exhibitions. in the last several months. What I like about the Smithsonian is that people feel free to talk about what's on their mind. And one of the things about the Smithsonian that I greatly admire and hope to support and perhaps even enlarge is the convening power of the institution to bring folks together to talk about important issues. Lately, one of the things we've been focusing on is cultural preservation. Some treasured cultural sites, artifacts, are in danger. They can be endangered by an act of nature, like the earthquake in Haiti. They can be endangered by destruction for those who disagree with the presence, as has happened in Syria and elsewhere. We're very active now with colleagues literally around the world to try to preserve cultural heritage that's so important so that people who come after you and I will understand what the world was like and will have a better take on what their world is at the time. It is a nonpartisan institution. It's a non-political institution. It's an institution devoted to creative activity and the seeking after truth. Controversies do arise in any creative activity, whether it's science or contemporary art or whatever. But I think the general mood here is one of trying to hear all sides and foster open discussion and open understanding.
Dr. David Skorden is secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. He'll be in the Valley on Friday as part of the O'Connor Institute's Distinguished Speakers Series. Dr. Skorden, thank you for the time.
Thanks so much.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Earlier this month, The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints made a dramatic rule change that will have a deep effect on LGBT members. The modification says members in same-sex marriages can be thrown out of the church, and their children have to wait until they're 18 years old and reject homosexual relationships in order to be baptized. To learn more and get a nuanced, complex reaction, I'm joined by John Gustav Rathall. He was raised a Mormon and is currently active in the church. He's also a member of the Board of Affirmation, LGBT Mormons, Families, and Friends. John, you had a very positive family experience in the church as a youngster in upstate New York. Many people, regardless of their religion, undergo a crisis of faith at some point, or they question what they've been taught. When did you first run into that, and then how did you handle it?
I'd say that I first became aware of my feelings of attraction to members of the same sex when I was about 10 or 11 years old. And I do remember being troubled by that and concerned about it, although I really just kind of shoved it off and tried not to think about it too much at that age. But really 14 years old was the point where I really became aware of this. And then that was when I finally had a word to attach to it, because I basically looked up the word homosexuality in the dictionary and realized, yeah, that's me. At about the age of 16, I decided that I read a book that you may have heard of called The Miracle of Forgiveness. And after reading that book, I became convinced that I would be able to overcome this. And so at about the age of 16, I read another book called The Spiritual Roots of Human Relations by Stephen R. Covey, and I thought, okay, he's offered me some techniques to really become closer to God and to deepen my spirituality. So I began to rise early in the morning to do calisthenics and pray and study the scriptures. And at that age, I also began to do regular splits with the missionaries to go out and preach the gospel and prepare myself for my own mission. I was able to serve a mission, a very honorable mission, but nothing really changed in terms of my feelings. And then when I came back and started going to BYU, that's where I really sort of tailspun into a pretty deep depression when I realized that this was not going away, no matter how faithful I had been. I did ultimately end up resigning from the church at that time. About 10 years ago, I had a spiritual experience that prompted me to come back to the church and become active in the church again. And so I've been very active in my ward here in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So in becoming more active, did your points of view evolved? Did you expect that because you felt more secure in yourself as a human being, or in some sense that the church would be more accepting of you? How do you go from feeling this one sense that the church is not going to accept you necessarily, or maybe you have struggled with that, and then you have this experience where you decide, this is an important part of my life, I want to go back?
At first, I had very little trust that the church would be accepting of me at all, but I felt that God was asking me to do this. And so it took me about a month to really kind of get up the courage and go back to church. And I went back expecting people not to accept me at all. But in fact, my ward very warmly embraced me. And over the years, they have become just an incredibly supportive community to me. And in fact, I now very much feel like my ward is kind of my personal sanctuary. It's my personal safe space. I can go there, and I know that people will love me and accept me for who I am. And that, in spite of the fact that I am in a relationship with a man, we are legally married. We got legally married in 2008, and we've been together for over 23 years. I gained insights into myself and achieved a level of self-understanding and acceptance. And my relationship with God was part of that journey. So I knew in coming back to the church that God wasn't saying to me, all the ways in which I've guided you over these last years, it's not that any of that is invalidated or no longer true, but I felt that I was being called to something deeper by reengaging with my faith and reengaging with the church. And in fact, it has, I would say that this has been the greatest blessing of my life.
I come back to the phrase safe place, and that may or may not apply to your specific ward, but in the more general sense, now that the church is changing the handbook of instruction as relates to same-sex couples and those who are married and their children. Was that a slap in the face or even worse?
When I first heard the news, it was a blow. It was, I don't know even how to describe it. I mean, it did feel like an assault initially. I didn't know quite how to absorb the news. And initially, a lot of people that I knew were sort of in disbelief about it. So that was definitely very difficult. And I did what I usually do in these situations. I prayed about it, and I really kind of felt an incredible sense of peace. And I knew that regardless of what the situation was with the policy, whether it was right or whether it was wrong, I felt that God was there with me and with my husband, and that he would see us through this. I went to church the following Sunday, there was a line of people coming up to me to give me hugs, reassure me of their love for me. And then the following Sunday, I actually sat down with my bishop for about an hour and discussed the policy with him and discussed the situation.
Do you feel like, though, the example you have set might change perception? Is that what it ultimately takes for people to, or the church as an institution to modify its views on this?
I think that in some sense, there has been a tremendous growth in understanding among members of the LDS Church in the last 5 to 10 years around this issue, and there's been a much deeper level of empathy on the part of church members toward their LGBT family members and members of their wards, and as those relationships have deepened, as the empathy has deepened, I think, yes, a lot of people are saying, yeah, there is a dilemma that we're facing here. There are questions that we need answers and that we hope our leaders can answer for us.
Even with the hurt and the challenges you've been through as a younger person in relating to the church, your approach, at least in our conversation, is so mature and so measured. Do you feel like you're in a place now where you have achieved a level of being able to look at this and be sort of a rock for your family and other people in the church who may be facing this?
I think I do feel like I have I've had the advantage of certain blessings, like the fact that I do have a family that's very supportive of me and very supportive of my relationship with my husband. And there was a point where my parents, for example, and this was before I chose to become reactivated in the church, but my parents were very unconditionally loving and supportive of me, and I think I am lucky to have a ward who have also been extraordinarily supportive. So that has given me a foundation to think about this and engage with this, as you say, I think in a more measured way. For all of us, this is going to be a journey. And I think at whatever level we are, wherever we are with this, whatever struggle this creates for us, I think that, you know, each of us are going to have to try to figure out how to respond to this in our own way. And I think whatever response we make, and for some people it may be that they need to just distance themselves from the church and leave and get some space, like I did for 19 years. I think what we have to do is just unconditionally love people. And that love gives people a space to grow, to figure things out, and to do that in a way that doesn't necessarily throw the baby out with the bathwater.
John Gustav Rathall, he's a member of the Board of Affirmation, LGBT Mormons, Families, and Friends, and he joined me from Minnesota. You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The Pulitzer Prize-winning play Disgraced explores a number of cultural themes, including the nature of religious faith. The centerpiece of the work includes four people sitting down for dinner, but the conversation doesn't feature small talk. Instead, the issues we're told aren't to be discussed over a polite meal, like religion and politics, lead to some intense exchanges. Disgraced is the latest production from Arizona Theater Company. It's continuing its run at the Herberger Theater Center in downtown Phoenix. Joining me now is Elijah Alexander, who portrays Amir, the play's lead character. Elijah, good morning. How are you?
Hello and good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me on. And thanks for being an advocate and a champion of ATC here.
Well, thanks. And let's hear about, give us some background first on the character you play. Who is Amir? What should we know about him?
Who is Amir? What should you know about him? Amir Kapoor, recently having changed his name, I say recently, within the last decade or so, from Amir Abdullah, is a corporate lawyer. Has been maybe 10, 12 years since he graduated law school. He's an American-born to Pakistani parents, so culturally and traditionally Pakistani. Also raised as a Muslim, but as I said, born in America, went through the sort of the chain of undergrad and higher education, like I said, law school, and into the workforce in New York. Started out in the public defender's office, and then moved into corporate law. A man who is also recently, as probably as recent as his name change, has become an apostate, or has renounced his faith officially or formally. So and with that, he changed his name. So
as I mentioned,
that's where we meet him.
And as I mentioned, there's some intense discussion in this play about some very heavy issues that people, as I said, tend not to talk about necessarily at a polite dinner. But I wonder, do you feel like, I mean, obviously it's a Pulitzer Prize winner, so I imagine the answer to this is yes, but as the actor, do you feel like the dialogue rings true? Does this feel like if people let down their airs and really talked about how they felt about these things, this is how they would talk?
Yes, I do. This is obviously, you know, as you said, it won the Pulitzer, so it's pretty tried and true. Mm-hmm. But it's coming from one man's experience, who is a Pakistani American born. You know, Ayad was born in the we call it the Midwest, in Milwaukee, and you know, moved to New York very early on, and so he has lived a lot of this. He has been to these dinner parties. He has met these people. He is expressing and exposing for us a lot of his own experiences. Of course, they're not always literal, you know, but you get the playwright's voice coming very strongly through this play. But yes, they're all people that I think we can relate to, whether you live on the East Coast or not, whether you've ever been to New York or not. They're dealing with issues that we all have had to face in our lifetime, meaning, you know, 9/11 is one topic that comes up over dinner, and everyone in this country has a relationship to that. So, you know, I bet everyone can say where they were when it happened, how they felt about it, their opinions about why it happened. So, yes, he's brought together a group of very relatable and very vulnerable in many ways to us, very very accessible to us. So it does really as an actor, it's a great gift to take on, you know, a role, a character that is this complex but this human.
So Elijah, when a play like this, which aims to get people to think about issues, is there pressure as well to try to provide answers, or is it more that when people leave the theater that they're talking about these issues and they're talking about them in an honest way?
That's a great question. I think that the playwright would agree. This is something that I espouse as well. I think that art's job, the job of art, is to provoke, to challenge, and to activate people's imaginations, to ask questions without giving any obvious answers. And, you know, Ayad, the playwright, said this in an interview. He said, you know, his job as an artist is about stirring the pot. It's about asking those questions, demanding that people ask those questions of themselves, but not to give any definitive sort of resolution. And that's very exciting because, of course, as an actor involved in this process, I have to answer the questions for myself. So I can't go out there and just ambiguously live the questions. You know, there's a searching that's involved, but I have to answer them for myself. That doesn't mean that someone watching Amir's journey and someone watching this play isn't going to have a completely different idea of what that answer is, if you follow me. A short answer is yes, to live the questions, to provoke, and to not answer, not to give inflict answers upon people. I think that's what audiences are leaving with, and it's I mean we're hearing the conversations in the lobby, we're hearing about conversations in the car on the way home, on the street. People are very provoked and inspired by that. So I think I think the playwright has the right idea in terms of part of what art's job is, the job of art. You know what I mean? The mighty purpose, behind a good work of art.
Actor Elijah Alexander portrays Amir, the lead character in Disgrace, which is the latest production from the Arizona Theater Company. You can see it in downtown Phoenix at the Herberger Theater Center. Elijah, thanks for squeezing us in this morning.
Oh, thanks so much, Steve. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The argument's been made that the U.S. and the world as well have spent too much time and money exploring outer space at the expense of the Earth's oceans. There's also an active concern about whether we're protecting the oceans enough and keeping them healthy. As part of the annual National Geographic Explorer Speaker Series at the Mesa Arts Center, oceanographer Sylvia Earle will discuss the wonders and fragility of the deep blue seas. Dr. Earle is affectionately known as Her Deepness. She was also named Time Magazine's first hero of the planet, and she joins me now. Dr. Earle, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me on board.
Well, so let's consider the fact that, I guess, what, 5% of the world's oceans have even been seen, let alone explored. That seems almost absurd. How does that hit you as someone who's actually explored some of those oceans?
The greatest era of exploration is just beginning. Pretty exciting.
But do you think people are invested and excited about that? We hear so much about we're going to go to Mars, we're going to do all these other things, which are obviously very exciting and important. Is there more attention, though, being paid to what's on this Earth as far as the oceans are concerned?
I wouldn't take a penny away from what's been invested and should be invested in exploring the skies above and the universe beyond, but an equal number of pennies to explore and understand and care for this part of the universe, our home, would be probably a useful thing for us to consider and actually do. Really, we've invested a lot, more to come, I trust, in what goes skyward. We've neglected the ocean. And it's costing us dearly. What we've done for space is paying off in so many ways. But I think that, so to speak, the tide is turning, that the awareness of why the ocean matters. Mm. With every breath we take, every drop of water we drink, we're connected. It doesn't matter whether we've ever seen or touched the ocean. It's obvious that the ocean touches us. Every day, in every way. And the view from space is one of the important turning points in the understanding that people have of why the ocean matters. The world is blue. Observed from afar, it just shines. And the magnitude of what we don't know is also beginning to come into focus. But we do know. We've learned more since I began exploring the oceans in the 1950s, than during all preceding human history. And some really big things, such as the mountain chains that run like giant backbones down the major ocean basins, like even the maximum depth of the ocean, the fact that the ocean is alive, that most of life on Earth is out there in the ocean. And it lives largely in the dark, below 1,000 feet. The average depth of the ocean is 2.5 miles. The maximum, 7 miles. Only 3 people have ever been to the deepest part of the ocean, 7 miles down. Think of the gazillions of people who travel 7 miles in the sky when they fly across the country or wherever they go in aircraft, let alone spacecraft.
So what needs to be done at this point to protect the oceans? I'm not even talking about the discoveries that we're talking about, but this idea of making sure that the oceans are healthy enough to lead to more exploration in the future. Does more emphasis need to be put on that?
At the same time that we've learned more than during all preceding history, it's pretty clear that we've lost more than during all preceding human existence. We have taken the ocean for granted. We, in the 50s, and many still believe that the ocean is too big to fail, that we can put into it whatever we want to, get rid of that stuff that we don't want near where we live, or to take out of it whatever we want, whether it's oil or gas or fish or minerals, that it's just like a free marketplace where we take but we don't have to give back. Well, we're beginning to understand the price of what we have extracted and the damage that we've inflicted. We've seen, again, during the same time of extraordinary exploration and new understanding about why the ocean matters, that it governs climate and weather. It shapes planetary chemistry and temperature. The ocean rules the world, full of life. And it's life in the ocean that really profoundly affects everything else. So generating oxygen, taking up carbon, driving, again, the chemistry of the planet. But what we have seen as a consequence of our actions, about half of the coral reefs have disappeared. 90% of many of the fish have been extracted. And the projection is that by the end, not even the end, by the middle of the 21st century, if we continue doing what we're doing, that commercial extraction of ocean wildlife, the fish, the lobsters, the clams, the oysters, mm-hmm. all the other things that we extract from the sea as, quote, seafood, and the products that we squeeze out of the krill and the fish and so on as oil or protein powder or whatever, that we will have topped out, that it will not be feasible to continue profitably extracting from the ocean, because there simply won't be enough left to make these endeavors realistic.
Just based on the nature of this being the National Geographic Explorers series, I need to bring back the fact that you mentioned that you've been doing this since the 50s, and technology, I'm sure, has changed just a little bit over the course of that time.
Oh,
but
yes.
If this were TV, we would show images of what you went in the water in, perhaps what you were wearing. Would you mind giving us a quick description of what it was like when you first started exploring, as opposed to how things changed over the decades? I mean, did you have just an enormous suit that weighed more than you did?
Well, it started with a bathing suit. And it continues that way. For a lot of exploration, it is just by observing and reporting and going into the ocean, and something that almost anybody can do, and to be a citizen scientist, if you will, to observe carefully, report honestly what you see. It started out that way with me as a kid, and I loved the joy of being free and to fly underwater using scuba. That was the first big breakthrough in the 50s, and continues right up to the present time, like last week and next week as well. Yeah. But I have had a chance to actually live underwater on 10 different occasions. We're in an underwater, like a bit like the space station, but you're in inner space, mm-hmm. where you have a warm, dry place to be 50 or 60 feet underwater, and you have a hole in the floor. Pressure keeps the water from coming in. You swim outside, and basically your time in the water is limitless, because you're already living under pressure, but you have to decompress or come back to surface conditions over 10 or 12 hours, 14 hours, something. It depends on how long you become fully saturated in about 24 hours, and the time that you return to surface pressure remains about the same. Depends on how much nitrogen you've taken up in your tissues during that time. Anyway, it gives you a different perspective, just as I'm sure living in space provides a different perspective, a different attitude about how you think about the world. And then beyond that, encasing yourself in a diving suit, whether it looks like a submarine, that's a diving system, that you're inside a one atmosphere container, again, like the spacecraft that keep those inside at surface pressure, one atmosphere, which is comfortable for human beings, unless you're going outside in a spacewalk, and then you have a slightly different pressure just to maintain the spacesuit to resist the lack of pressure outside. But it's basically, you're at one atmosphere. And in a submarine, or in the walking suit that I used called Jim, named after the first person, Jim Jarrett, who put it on back in the 1920s, but in a new version, a spiffed-up version that I tried in 1979, to enable me as a diver, as an individual, as a scientist, to slip into this suit. It looks a lot like an astronaut suit, but it is made of metal, so metal arms and metal legs. Uh-huh. I feel like a big robot, but with a human being stuffed inside. To walk around, I had a chance to do this at 1,250 feet, about 400 meters, and to really be a part of the ocean. And one of the great things about being in a one-person, whether it's a diving suit or a one-person sub, is that you have the same kind of eye, mind, hand coordination that you have when you're on land, whether you're riding a bicycle or climbing a tree or sitting in a room. It's you're just there as an individual in charge, but you just happen to be wrapped in a container.
We just have a few seconds left. Yeah, we're just trying to whet people's appetite for tonight. But this is maybe a 30-second answer.
All right.
You're so humble, hero of the planet, but Have you felt like you've been able to inspire not just other young women, but other people to get involved in this profession?
I hope so. I want everyone to know why the ocean matters and to do what they can to take care of it, to protect the ocean. Parks in the ocean, it's an idea whose time has come. Currently, about 2% of the ocean is protected in the same way we do the land.
Oceanographer Dr. Sylvia Earle, we just scratched the surface, which I'm not sure is a proper term based on what we're talking about, but she's part of the National Geographic Explorers Speaker Series. Tonight at the Mesa Arts Center at 7:30, she'll be showing amazing images, telling more great stories. Dr. Earle, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me here.